My name is Allie. A month ago, my cousin and co-host Adam disappeared under mysterious circumstances, and the only way to find him again is by solving the mysteries of the monster world. You know, I looked it up. Apparently the House of Gaga does not have a copyright on Little Monsters as a podcast fandom specifically. Funnily enough, I think we're in the clear. I'm Allie. This is Finding Monster Right. After Dark. The Allie Files. Hey, Little Monsters. So, the outfit that I've got for today's episode, combined with the subject matter, is really reading a lot of Femme Milo from Atlantis. Did I get dressed up for an audio-only recording? Yeah, it's what I do. Anyway, the reason that's funny is that that's normally Adam's aesthetic. And I do have another hint as to Adam's disappearance. I think the era of Adam-less Finding Monster Right is coming to a close, for better or worse. I feel like I've grown, but, you know, maybe I haven't and I just stink. But anyway, the hint. So, I was at my favorite local coffee place, and I spilled a couple drops on the floor. And as I was cleaning it up, I saw two sentences in the knots in the grain. In the forest, I must wait until the fair ones cast my fate. That's capital N, apostrophe, T-I-L. It's the same number of syllables as the word until. So I don't know why that is, but you know what? I've never written a message in wood, so I don't know. Wherever Adam is, it's somewhere with wood. You think I should have watched that Twilight Zone episode from last week? Man, you'd think that'd be a good hint, right? I probably should have done that, but I didn't. But don't worry, I'm taking this very seriously. Adam will be found soon, I'm sure. But you know what won't be found anytime soon, probably, is evidence of those who came before us. Did that sound like I planned it? I didn't. Good at podcasting. So, the Silurian hypothesis. It's a thought experiment, first proposed in a 2018 paper by Adam Frank, an astrophysicist at the University of Rochester, and Gavin Schmidt, director of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies. In this paper, what the two authors argue is it might be possible to detect evidence of a previous advanced civilization in the geological record. This is an astrophysicist and someone who is primarily a climatologist. So a lot of their evidence is kind of based around that. They begin by talking about the relevance to the Drake equation. So the Drake equation is an attempt at solving the Fermi paradox. Now, these are normal words that everybody knows, right? Just because I've known them since I was 12, everybody does. Everybody's talking about the possibility of space aliens all the time. I still don't think about the Roman Empire that much, though, so I'm still good. In any case, the Drake equation posits that the number of advanced civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy is equal to the product of the average rate of star formation in our galaxy, the fraction of formed stars that have planets, the average number of planets per star that can potentially support life, the fraction of those planets that actually develop life, the fraction of those planets bearing life on which intelligent, civilized life has developed, the fraction of these civilizations that have developed communications, the length of time over which civilizations release detectable signals. And this is for searching for extraterrestrial life via radio signals, like the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI, is famous for doing. Are they at the beginning of Independence Day? I think that's right. The notion of multiple civilizations occurring over the history of a planet indicate that the value, the fraction, rather, of planets that have developed intelligent life may be greater than one. And that's important for considering this equation that estimates the number of civilizations that exist in our galaxy. It's also useful for finding evidence of advanced civilizations or life on Mars or Venus, or in the geologic record of those places, rather. But what exactly is all this evidence? So the notion of an industrial civilization occurring before humans, well, it would have had to have happened since the rise of complex life on land, which is around the Devonian period, is the, well, that's the metric they give. During the period right before that, the Silurian, the only animals on land were arthropods and plants. I, for one, think it's very ignorant to rule out Bug Planet, but that's just me. It also rules out the possibility of purely ocean-based life forms, because it's difficult to start a civilization, an industrial civilization, in the ocean, simply because you can't have fire underwater. So you can't have cooked food. You can't have ceramics. And, of course, you can't have metalworking. But it's not all looking for aliens and things like that. It's also an important consideration for thinking about the geological footprint that we are having as an industrial civilization currently here in the Anthropocene. It is possible that for all our pollution and all our chemicals that we are laying down and all that, the Anthropocene will most likely only appear as a section a few centimeters thick and appear almost instantaneously in the record, as they put it. So what are some of the types of evidence that they talk about putting out? Anomalies of carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, and nitrogen. So essentially the burning of fossil fuels, use of fertilizer and other industrial waste. This is going to create anomalies in stable isotopes of carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, and nitrogen in the fossil record. And that can occur anytime after the Carboniferous period, when all of this coal that we're currently burning was formed. That was before trees could be decomposed effectively by bacteria. So they just acted as carbon sinks that could take carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, get buried, get fossilized, idiot, and then over time become coal. And it wasn't until bacteria developed the ability to digest lignin, which is a plant protein, that this stopped happening. Is this boring? I feel like I'm trying to be less boring here in the back nine of Finding Monster Right solo episodes, and I feel we are in the back nine. I'm going to spice it up a little bit. Oh, here's something interesting. Faunal radiations and extinctions. Now, the authors of the paper, they stay in their lane to some extent. Obviously, people are going to bring this up, and so it's worth talking about, but this is not their area of expertise. They're an astrophysicist and a climatologist. They're not an ecologist. They're not a zoologist or a biologist of any sort. This is not their field. They don't get too crazy with it. Well, before we get into that, there's non-naturally occurring synthetics, things like plastics and transuranic elements. So, you know, radioactive things that are not, that are rare earth elements. It is possible to detect that to some degree, different radioactive elements break down at different rates. So, for example, plutonium-244 has a half-life of 80.8 million years, and curium-247 has a half-life of 15 million years. So after 80 million years, that means that there's that half of the plutonium-244 has stabilized into a more stable isotope. And then after another 80 million years, another half of it, now there's a fourth of it left, and so on and so forth. And you can use that to date things. Now, we have not found anything like that in the fossil record or the geologic record, but let's talk about fossils. So the vast majority of organisms never fossilize. It is entirely possible that that includes whole species, even whole large species with hard body parts, like humans. It is possible that no human fossil will ever be discovered by any successive terrestrial or extraterrestrial intelligence. A haunting thought, but nonetheless true. What that also means is that it's possible that there is a fossil of an intelligent life form that evolved here, on Earth, our predecessor. Just think about that for a moment. Just sit on that thought. My religiosity, I feel, has gone not down since I abandoned organized religion, which, you know, not every queer person does, but some of us feel compelled to do so. And I feel like what reverence I have left is reverence for the concept of deep time itself. Just billions upon billions of years. It's staggering to think that we are one little piece of genes and macromolecules that's assembled, that's tricked itself into thinking that we're alive, and that that's descended from generations of human beings, and that's a species that has descended from various different hominids, and that's descended from, that goes all the way back through the Cenozoic era to weird little tree shrews and weird little therapsids in the late Paleozoic. It goes back further to tetrapods crawling out of the sea in the Devonian period, back further to the first chordates in the Precambrian, back further to the very first molecule, the first organic piece of life. Whatever that very fuzzy barrier is between non-living and living, at some point, under a red sky, because there is not as much oxygen in an atmosphere with no photosynthesis, under a red sky in a stormy sea beset by comets, the very first thing decided to live. And that is a lot better than some big Jewish man in the sky with a big long beard and sandals who tells you not to jack off. Oh, okay. My atheist screed is over now. So I promised we would put a pin in the fossil record of things. And we're going to take that pin out. So they talk about some very surface level kind of stuff. Maybe a little bit deeper than surface level. I'll give them some credit, of course. But they talk about how humans in their time have created a proliferation of wide swaths of populations of invasive species, whether it's pests or pets or animals domesticated as livestock or plants domesticated as crops, even. It makes sense that they point this out because I think this would be noticeable over a certain amount of time in the fossil record. I think I remember reading something that, like, the highest population of mammals on Earth is cows, followed by humans, followed by several species of domestic animal, and then every wild mammal on Earth is a fraction of a percent. Bats, rats, mice, anything. Just a tiny sliver compared to cows. And, you know, what's that going to look like in the fossil record? Just a huge species die-off and then a bunch of cows. If we ever found anything like that in the fossil record, I would have to... Wait a minute. Wait a minute, there is something like that in the fossil record. Oh my god. Wait. Okay, so, how do we get to this? When animals first crawled out of the sea, really freshwater habitats, but when animals with backbones crawled out of the sea, they became, they were lobe-finned fish, and then they became more like amphibians over time, right? And there's still some lobe-finned fish, like the lungfish and coelacanths, and those are a split-off of our kind of fish that we all are, right? So then you get the first reptiles, and they are special because they're amniotes, right? They lay eggs on dry land. Instead of laying their eggs in water, they produce eggs for their young that work like little ponds that the eggs can develop in. And that group, the amniotes, splits off into the sauropsids and the synapsids. And the synapsids are tending to go in this evolutionary direction, sort of. They become more mammal-like over time, because a lot of mammal-like adaptations are seen as more advantageous, or found to be more advantageous in that environment. I'm being very orthogenic in this, in that comment. They experiment crazy. There's animals that have, like, tiny heads and heads that are way too big, and that thing with the big sail on its back, Dimetrodon, that's a synapsid. They had, like, these gorgonopsids, which were, like, saber-tooth, tiger, wolf, alligator things. Love those guys. But those guys really took off. And the sauropsids, which were these like little lizard guys, they were kind of in the shadows of the synapsids. And then came an event called the Great Dying. The Permian-Triassic extinction event happened 252 million years ago. 95% of Earth dies in this event. Reading directly across from Wikipedia.
The precise cause of the Great Dying remain unknown. The scientific consensus is that the main cause of the extinction was the flood basalt volcanic eruptions that created the Siberian traps, which released sulfur dioxide and carbon dioxide, resulting in eunuchia and euxinia and anoxia, elevating global temperatures and acidifying the oceans. The level of atmospheric carbon dioxide rose from about 400 parts per million to 2,500 parts per million, with approximately 3,900 to 12,000 gigatons of carbon being added to the ocean atmosphere system during this period. Important proposed contributing factors include the emission of much additional carbon dioxide from the thermal decomposition of hydrocarbon deposits, including oil and coal, triggered by the eruptions, emissions of methane from the gasification of methane clathrates, emissions of methane possibly by novel methanogenic microorganisms nourished by mineral deposits in the eruptions, an extraterrestrial impact creating the Araguana crater and consequent seismic release of methane, and the destruction of the ozone layer and increase in harmful solar radiation.
Literally all of those. Burning fossil fuels, acidifying the oceans, raising the global temperatures. Methane. It's those cows again. Cows produce, as a waste product, methane, a greenhouse gas many orders of magnitude stronger than carbon dioxide. That's why vegetarians have it right. I hate to say it, folks, but we all have to go vegetarian. I don't like it either. Adam's not here, baby. I'm running the show. All of these things, though, all of these things sound like the effects that humans are having on their environment today. And what happens after the Great Dying? Well, as I said, the great experiment of Earth, those first organisms that decided to live, almost all died. It almost ended. And the synapsids went mostly extinct, except for a few small groups that would go on to form the crown mammalia, mammals, like you and me. And the sauropsids, well, the sauropsids went on to form virtually every other kind of reptile. Lizard, snakes, turtles, crocodiles, dinosaurs, and birds. The point is, it took the dinosaurs a little bit of time to take off, and once they did, they really did. But right after the Great Dying, it looked like the synapsids might make a bit of a comeback. In the early Triassic period, the first period of the Age of Dinosaurs, as we call it,
the most common terrestrial vertebrates, accounting for as many as 95% of the total individuals in some fossil beds,
is a kind of animal called Lystrosaurus, an animal that ranges in size from that of a small dog to 8 feet long. What if the Permian-Triassic extinction event wasn't caused by the flood basalt volcanic eruptions that created the Siberian traps? What if there was an industrial civilization on Earth at this time that farmed Lystrosaurus the way we farm cattle? They ruined the Earth. They went extinct, killing themselves and almost all of the planet in the process. And all that was left of them was their livestock. Maybe they didn't last that long. Maybe they burned bright and burned quickly, and that's why we don't see much in the way of evidence or of global colonization, because, you know, it's not like Lystrosaurus is everywhere. Lystrosaurus remains are found mostly around what is now
India, China, Mongolia, European Russia, and South Africa.
All continents and all places that were surrounding a continent called Antarctica. What if this civilization of Lystrosaurus farmers, of some unknown taxonomy, maybe they themselves were also a kind of synapsid, in some ways, in more ways than one, are precursors as intelligent civilization-building synapsids. We know that this taxon is capable of developing intelligence, and it's not as if intelligence takes a certain amount of time to cook. Maybe something came up in Antarctica, and the evidence of that evolutionary lineage is buried under the continental ice shelf of the Antarctic, and that's why we've never found it. Maybe if we dig far enough beneath Antarctica, we'll find something big. I said that deep time was my religion. and I fear I have become a prophet of it. Prophet of a dead race. A race of gods and kings.
I am. Before everything was, I am.
Well, now that we know that I'm God, let's read more of this paper.
We are aware that raising the possibility of a prior industrial civilization as a driver for events in the geological record might lead to rather unconstrained speculation. One would be able to fit any observations to an imagined civilization in ways that would be basically unfalsifiable. Thus, care must be taken not to postulate such a cause until actual positive evidence is available. The Silurian hypothesis cannot be regarded as likely merely because no other valid idea presents itself.
They formed the Lystrosaurus. I'm a god. Okay. That may have gotten away from me. No, you know what? The last paragraph of this paper gives me bad vibes.
Perhaps unusually, the authors of this paper are not convinced of the correctness of their proposed hypothesis. Were it to be true, it would have profound implications, and not just for astrobiology. However, most readers do not need to be told that it is always a bad idea to decide on the truth or falsity of an idea based on the consequences of it being true. While we strongly doubt that any previous industrial civilization existed before our own, asking the question in a formal way that articulates explicitly what evidence for such civilization might look like raises its own useful questions related both to astrobiology and to Anthropocene studies. Thus, we hope that this paper will serve as motivation to improve the constraints on the hypothesis so that in the future we may be better placed to answer our title question.
Now that clearer heads have prevailed, while I understand that maybe sci-fi pitches are not the best way to go about deciding scientific theories, however, I do find it a bit rich that in the same sentence where you say, "Oh, dinosaur times, people? That's crazy. But this theory might help us find space aliens." That's as silly. Come on. That's as silly an idea that there's space civilizations as deep time civilizations. You know, you're looking for signs of intelligent life. You're looking for evidence of past industrial civilizations on 1,000 planets that might have life, maybe, in their geologic past. But for some reason, the notion that there was intelligent life, like, scientists universally say, yes, there is, in all likelihood, intelligent civilizations in our galaxy besides us. Yet, it's so crazy to think that there was civilization on a planet that we know has life now. And maybe there weren't Lystrosaurus farmers back in the day, but if there were, I'm their king and queen. I can do anything. And if they caused the great dying, maybe there's a lesson to be learned. It's a pretty good religion, as long as it has some kind of flood myth, some kind of Noah or Nanapush or Gilgamesh myth of destroying the entire planet except for a small fraction of life and starting over. We need to look at what we're doing, and we need to choose. And if there's evidence that some intelligent life form, some predecessor, not alien, but very, very terrestrial, fucked around and found out before us, maybe finding evidence of that would be really, really good for us. Maybe we might be able to stop it from happening again. If it's not already too late. Thanks for listening, everybody. Wow! Finding Monster Right does not end on a bummer note like that. That's not Finding Monster Right, Allie. Okay, well, alright, so... what do you get when you cross an elephant and a rhino? Elephino. Ugh. We gotta get Lemma back. Stay safe out there, little monsters, and remember to always believe in yourself, because I believe in you. Also, I'm God. All right, bye.